Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Stephen Batchelor, who's an author of several books on Buddhism, often from a secular perspective. He also runs regular retreats around the world with his wife, Martine. However, he's here to talk to us today about his interest in photography and collage and how he sees this as an integrative practice in his life. We'll then go on to talk about the importance of the arts in general as a medium of expression and communication and how this can relate to the middle way. Stephen, welcome to the MWS podcast.
Thank you, Barry. Very glad to be here.
Okay, so to start off, have you always been creative? Were you encouraged to be creative as a child?
Yes, probably yes. Maybe not in so many words, but I grew up with a strong awareness of my great uncle, who had died two or three years before I was born. And he was both a sculptor and a photographer. Uh-huh. And so, you know, he was the sort of a bit of a black sheep of the family, but I rather admired him from a young age. I liked the fact that he had broken away from convention and had taken the risk to be an artist, and to do that had actually emigrated to the US. My mother also, I grew up as a single child with my mother, and she too had a strong interest in the arts as a young woman. And so both my brother and I were brought up in a family that had not necessarily an explicit, but an implicit valuation of the arts and the creative process.
Yeah. Okay. And was it your uncle that had an influence on you actually choosing photography over other visual arts?
Probably not, because when I was a child, I never actually saw any of his photographs. I only saw those more recently. But I honestly don't quite know what it was that pushed me in the direction of photography. I can't recall very clearly. We did have a family business at that time too, which was photo engraving. It's a very old-fashioned way of producing plates for printing pictures in newspapers.
Yeah.
I sometimes used to work there in the summer as a kid, and I used to work in the photography studio there. So I was kind of grew up in that milieu, let's say, and I can't point to any one single event or experience that sort of moved me towards photography, but I suspect, you know, from a general sense of the conditions under which I lived, it was not an unusual or unlikely thing to have wanted to do.
Okay. I described it as an interest. Is it an interest or a passion?
I think at the beginning, when I was like 16 or so, it was probably more a passion and a vocation, actually.
Yeah.
Because when I did my A-levels at grammar school in Watford, I had already a place at the Regent Street Polytechnic, as it was then, to do a 2-3 year course in professional photography. So that was clearly where I was going, but I did so badly at my A-levels that I failed to get the required number to be accepted in the course. And so then I went off to India for a gap year that lasted 13 years, and I came back as a Buddhist monk. And so my whole career as a photographer was derailed by Buddhism.
Yeah.
And I didn't really pick up a camera again until I went to South Korea to train as a Zen monk.
And why did you actually pick it up?
Again, it's a good question. I don't really know. I am aware of the fact that throughout my time as a Tibetan Buddhist monk, the arts in general were broadly discouraged. It wasn't seen to be a particularly important thing to do. There were some of us monks who wanted to continue playing musical instruments. That wasn't allowed, and so on and so forth. And also, I think I really did accept that view, that the arts were a distraction from enlightenment. And so I really didn't do anything in that period. But when I went to Korea, one of the reasons I went was because I became aware of how all the Buddhist traditions, the Zen, Chan, in Korea they call it Son Buddhism, did not have a problem with the arts, as we know. I mean, we have the beautiful Zen calligraphies and paintings and so on and so forth. And many of the monks in the monastery in South Korea did some form of artistic work, be it tea ceremony, be it painting, be it whatever. Yeah. And that was a very conducive environment for my pursuing my interest in photography. So I brought a tiny little Rollei 35mm camera, and I took lots of photographs, and I really began to get into that medium again.
Do you think when you were very involved in the Tibetan tradition, was that something that you felt was missing in some way? And as you say, did that play a part? Was that a significant part in your interest in Zen?
Yeah, it was actually. But my interest in Zen and my frustration with the Tibetan traditions was, in a sense, sort of revolving around these issues. To me, any tradition that veers towards the more dogmatic end of the spectrum is unlikely to encourage creativity or imagination. In other words, it's not the sort of thing they want people to do, to think for themselves or to come up with, say, you know, original artistic ideas. That simply doesn't fit with a view of the world that basically describes how reality is and claims that its teachings are a path that constitutes a way out of the dilemma of samsara. And if photography and art and creativity are not included in that path, then they're obviously of no value at all.
Yeah.
Whereas in Zen, it's rather different.
Okay. Do you think then that the arts play a big role in helping us to tolerate ambiguity?
Possibly. I've not quite thought of it in those terms before, but certainly, the arts is a little bit too grand. Let's just stick to what I do, photography and more latterly film and collage.
Yeah.
I think by learning to look acutely and alertly and with an open mind through a viewfinder of a camera is a device that helps us to look at the world more honestly. And in terms of photography, of course, we're doing more than just looking at the world. We're actually trying to configure what we see into what we would consider a work of art.
Yeah.
In other words, to transcend a simple recording of an image, as one would in, say, a snapshot, and actually seeking through the medium of the camera to transform what we're seeing into something other, something else. Right. And that, to me, is central to my whole engagement with the arts, is how we transform perception, how we take the raw materials of the world.
Yeah.
And turn them into something that is greater than just the sum of details that we happen to be perceiving with our eyes in that moment.
Okay. And then when did collage come into the picture?
Collage. There was a continuity because my photography was increasingly turning to take photographs of things that you would otherwise not notice.
Yeah.
In other words, I was less and less interested in taking photographs of things that are visually somehow standing out. Like people will see a beautiful sunset and they'll all raise their cameras up and photograph the sunset because the sunset is, wow, such a beautiful thing, or rainbows and stuff like that. Instead, and again, this I think is very much in keeping with the Zen approach, is to turn one's attention to the ordinary details of your daily life that you tend to overlook and just sort of blank out as boring and uninteresting. But by heightening attention on the ordinary, you begin to uncover visually a sense of how extraordinary those simple things can be. So yeah. Some of those fascinating, or not fascinating, but some of those satisfying photographs I've taken have been very mundane things, but seen in such a way that they transcend their ordinariness and reveal something which is out of the ordinary.
Yeah, well, this ties in with your an expression I've heard you use, the everyday sublime.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the everyday sublime is my way of talking about how through meditation in particular, and also through Buddhist philosophy and Buddhist thought, we sort of deconstruct our habitual patterns of perception and our habitual sort of internal narrative and learn to still our minds and stop. And as we do that, I think the world opens up in not only the world opens up not just as something more clear or vivid, but somehow also as something more beautiful. Yeah. I think there's an aesthetic dimension to insight, just as there is an affective dimension and a cognitive dimension. But I'm not really aware of many, if any, Buddhist texts that really address the aesthetics of meditation. And so my interest in photography, collage, and so on is very much has to be seen in the aspect of the aesthetics of spiritual experience, the aesthetics of Buddhist experience, the aesthetics of insight, if you wish. And I call that the everyday sublime. In other words, to experience the world from the perspective of, let's say, the four tasks that I speak of embracing dukkha and letting go of craving and stopping and then cultivating a way of life. That if we look at the world through that in that way, I feel that it does awaken an aesthetic appreciation. And at the same time, therefore, the baddies in Buddhism, greed, hatred, egoism, and so on, I think we can begin to understand as being anesthetics. Yeah. They numb us, they dull us. They don't just make us more confused and give us rise to lots of suffering, although they might do that. But one of the other consequences of living in a world determined by those drives is that the world is rendered opaque and flat and uninteresting.
Yeah.
And so the arts, I think, to me, work very much as a practice of embracing dukkha, embracing the totality of our life condition, but in a way that's particularly alert to its aesthetic.
Okay, just back to you specifically working with collage and photography. You use the term found objects. Does that relate to what you're saying?
Yeah, it does. You see, I began to realize when I was taking photographs of just ordinary things from funny angles or whatever, that what I was valuing were the things that I found.
Right, yeah.
In other words, things that I just stumbled across, I saw out of the corner of my eye or whatever.
Yeah, okay.
So there's something about a photograph that it is a found object already. And the collage, though, that I can remember when that process began. It goes back, in fact, to a very vivid memory I have when I was about 11 or 12 years old. And I had, in those days, we used to have these ring fold binders we used to keep our papers in at school. And in one of those ring fold binders, I just cut up lots of different bits of magazines and stuff and arranged them inside the clear plastic cover of the folder in a form of collage. And I found that, although I was doing it I can't remember my motives, but I was very, very satisfied and fascinated with the result. And that's a very, very key moment in my upbringing. And I didn't do collage until maybe 30 years later, when I was actually, and what triggered it was a trip I made to London with my brother and my mother July 1995.
Yeah.
And I was sitting in the train going back to Devon, where I lived at the time, and I was emptying out my pockets of all the stuff that we'd kind of accumulated over that weekend, you know, theatre tickets and a little program for an art gallery and the Sunday paper and whatever it was. And it suddenly struck me that this was what would generally be seen as rubbish, stuff you would just chuck away, stick in a garbage bin or whatever. And I don't know why, but it occurred to me, well, maybe I could transform this rubbish into an object of beauty, much in the same way as I would transform an ordinary object lying on the street into hopefully a good photograph.
Yeah.
And so when I got home back to Devon, I started playing around with this idea. I started cutting out, I started glued these bits of stuff onto card, started cutting them up, playing around with them. And that really was the beginning of a process that continues up until today. I mean, I'm still doing this. It's moved on an awful lot, but the basic idea has remained the same. It's working with the detritus of the world and transforming how we relate to it, rather than as useless rubbish,
yes,
is actually something that is potentially a work of art, a work of beauty.
Do you feel, in a sense, when you're creating a collage, that you're sculpting?
Yeah, there's definitely an element in in collage that brings my hands and my body into an engagement with the practice, and that I feel as an intellectual, as a writer, you tend to get rather lost in your head. And working with collage, and ditto with photography. Photography again is very much a very physical relationship with the environment.
Yeah.
And collage likewise. I'm absolutely drawn to the textures of the materials I work with, the way they actually feel between my fingers. I often literally physically caress with the fingers the surfaces of my work. I find that deeply satisfying. I don't know why. It's all a bit crazy, really. But that's just how it goes. And so it brings I can actually feel it in my hands.
Yeah.
The working with the materials, the cutting of the materials, the gluing of the materials. This does two things. It takes me out of my head.
Yeah.
In other words, it's not something that's conceptually even really intelligible. That's why it's so difficult to talk about.
Yeah.
In a sense, you know, you have to see the work. And I can't really, when we decided we wouldn't try and show the work.
Yeah.
But that's another story. But it certainly has that function of bringing one's whole physical relationship with the environment into what for me is an extension of my practice as a Dharma.
Yeah. There are various tensions in art, for example, representation versus expressivism or regulation versus freedom. How do you navigate these polarities in your work?
Well, representation is something that I seek to move away from. And in that regard, I think I was influenced by the work of my brother, David, who's quite a well-known artist. He just had a show open in Bristol this weekend. I was there. Called Flatlands. It's a plug, David. It's a plug. I was very much, when I got the idea of non-representational art, in other words, the picture is not there to represent something that it's not, but the picture somehow it has an autonomy and a value in its own right. You're actually just looking at the surface and the material and the stuff of the image itself. That was a sort of revelation to me when that penny finally dropped.
Yeah.
And so that helped me very much in working with collage as a kind of parallel process, a corollary, as it were, of my written work.
Mm.
And so collage becomes a kind of silent commentary, silent commentary on what I write. And I keep it very much to myself. I don't show my work, but it's like writing is a form of composition. It's about putting words and sentences and paragraphs together. And also it's an aesthetic process, because at some point you say, yes, that sentence really does follow that sentence. It sounds good. It sounds right. It's agreeable in some way. So there is an aesthetic dimension to that, but it's still very much a conceptual process. So it's trying to find, you know, the most effective working of a certain argument to make a point. Now, once you take words and concepts out of the story and you're just working with colors, as I am, color bits of paper, and organizing them together, you are doing so on a far more intuitive level. And I can't explain this, but I feel that my writing is actually just 50% of the creative process that's actually going on in the course of composing a book.
Oh, interesting.
The rest is collage as a rule, or film or whatever. Mainly collage.
Yeah. Okay. Do you think you can communicate? Well, we've been talking about this, but the idea that you can communicate things to yourself and others through art that you can't do through other mediums.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't do it. I mean, Henry Moore was once asked, you know, what does this statue mean? You know, what's it about? And he said, well, if I could answer that question, I wouldn't have had to make the statue.
Right.
In other words, and this is, I've heard other variants on that response, because artists are often asked that. And if you could put it into words, what you're trying to communicate through art, you wouldn't have to do the art. It's as simple as that. And the art has the, to me, great strength of not relying upon discursive thought, of not relying upon it having a clear-cut meaning that some clever person can then define in other words. And in that sense, it transcends the limits of what can be stated, what can be, you know, defined. And it speaks, I think, from a more holistic, if we can use that word, a quality of experience. We're actually, when I'm through a painting or through a photograph or through a film, I feel I'm able to say something that brings more, how do you say it? I can say something more effectively than I could possibly communicate it in words. But even I can't say what it is I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Okay. How does this all relate to your understanding of the middle way?
Well, this is where it gets a little bit tricky without actually being able to show you the work itself. But collage, I don't just sort of cut pieces of paper up and bits of card and bits of plastic and then just sort of glue them willy-nilly onto a piece of card. I follow a very, very formulaic principles of organization of the material. And that brings into play a tension between between chance and order, or randomness and order. In other words, the materials are random. They're not things I buy or go out to get. They're things I find. There's the element of chance there. It's just what I'll stumble across. But there's very much an element of order and control in the way that these found objects are arranged. And they're arranged on grid patterns, a bit like mosaics. And they're cut in particular ways that follow certain, I suppose, if I were a mathematician, there's probably some algorithms at work somewhere. But I don't think mathematically. I find that the organizing structures of my work actually come to me as I'm thinking in pictures. I know that might sound strange. That many of the key moves in the development of my collage art have come to me almost as sort of epiphanies I've seen in my mind, you know, where the thing is going next. And it's very difficult to describe what's going on there. But that's, in a sense, the sort of dynamic, the element of chance, which seems to trigger and perpetuate a particular sense of structure and order. Now, part of that structure, and so I'm getting to your point, don't worry, part of that structure has to do with a rather firm insistence on the principle of identity and difference. In other words, one of my rules is I never put two pieces of material together. I never let two pieces of material that are identical touch. So let's give me an example. I have a large work about 70 centimeters square, composed of about 1,024 white squares. And those white 1,024 white squares are cut-ups of 81 pieces of found white paper. Now, when you're walking down the street and you see a piece of white paper, you just say, oh, there's a piece of white paper. Oh, there's another piece of white paper. Oh, there's another piece of white paper. And you get them all together. And when you start putting them side by side, you realize that none of them are the same. They, in other words, they somehow illuminate the tension between things we would conventionally say, oh, that, and that, they're the same. They're both white. And yet when you put them next to each other, you realize, well, actually, they're not the same. They're different. They're both the same and different, in other words. So it, what I'm playing with is this sameness and difference. Now, this is, of course, a key argument in Madhyamaka philosophy, that things do not have inherent existence because they are not identical or different from other things. The categories of identity and difference are incapable of capturing the contingency, the fluidity, the emergence and the unfolding of life itself. So at some level, although this might sound terribly abstract, I'm trying to somehow play with the tension between identity and difference that somehow helps reveal the world as not reducible to our classical, linguistic categories, such as those of identity and difference. And that, of course, is the way of looking at shunyata, which is, of course, the middle way.
Yeah. Okay. All right, I've got a question now from Richard Flanagan.
Oh, Richard Flanagan. Hello, Rich. How are you doing?
Yeah. To what extent do you feel that engaging in photography can challenge existing assumptions one might have about a potential subject, be it an object, place or person? Can you think of any examples from your experience?
Yeah, I can think of a very good example. Most of the photographs that are on my website, which you might be showing on this video, I don't know, are actually reflections. And I started becoming very, very interested in reflected light. And especially our urban environments. When you walk down a high street, when you're walking by a bunch of shops, for example, you're actually seeing a double world, but you edit out one. When you look into the shop window, you might see, whatever it is, radios or shoes or whatever. Mm-hmm. But you're also seeing, but editing out, the reflection of the street behind. It's just as visual. It's just as present. But we edit it out because that it's not useful, if you like. If you want to buy a pair of shoes, you want to get a clear look at the pair of shoes. You don't want to switch your focus to the point where you see the people walking beside you on the pavement. Now, I found this somewhat of a revelation, that if you are photographing into a reflective surface, you're actually seeing two things. You're seeing the surface and you're seeing what's reflected in it. And if you push it further, everything is all imagery is reflected light. Mm-hmm. It's light bouncing off the image. If that surface is shiny enough, then it actually reveals images of its own. And when I started to train myself to notice this, rather than ignore it and just focus on the shoes or the radios in the shop, my whole visual world was doubled,
yeah,
instantly. And I actually went through a long period of forcing myself to notice the reflected sort of shadow world, if you like, that is present all around us, that we edit out. And then, and again, it even surprised me initially that you could photograph this shadowed world. And if you play with the depth of field, which I do a lot, you know about depth of field, it has to do with the aperture. If you photograph at a high aperture number like f16 or f22, you get a very deep depth of field. So it means that you can get both images in focus. You can get the shoes and the people on the street walking by equally in focus because you've got an extended depth of field. So you start realizing you're actually photographing a double world. And the camera can capture that much more accurately than the human brain. The human brain is an editing machine in many ways. It's designed to sort of highlight what we want and what we don't like and what's dangerous. A camera doesn't have those interests. Camera is just a machine. But Cartier-Bresson, who's one of the great photographers, called a camera an instrument of intuition and spontaneity. It's not the sort of idea you would tend to think of when you pick up a great big Nikon, but he's absolutely right. It sort of takes you out of your brain in a weird way, and it becomes a device whereby to experience the world anew.
Yeah.
Now, to me, I'm very also very much taken by the idea that the purpose of art is not to present something that's beautiful, but it is to force us to see the world in a new way, in a way we haven't yet done.
Right.
And so the series of photographs I did of reflections, of which I took hundreds and hundreds of shots, is about 35 on the website.
Yeah.
All of these, and people say, "Oh, you photoshopped it." No. I meant that they're WYSIWYG. They are just single shots on silver, chemical film, not digital or anything like that. The photograph therefore forces you to realize you could, there are other ways of looking at the world than you are habitually prejudiced to do so. And this, of course, again, has resonances with Buddhism.
Yeah.
We tend to see the world determined by our egoism, our attachments, our fears, our aversions, and so on. And that actually locks our sense of the world into place and what renders it, as I've already mentioned, very often rather dull and uninteresting. I think the two go hand in hand.
Okay.
Photography is a means whereby to somehow break through that rigidity of visual conditioning, to open up the world as far richer and far more ambiguous, as you said earlier, than it had it superficially appears. So it is about opening up ambiguity. In other words, that too is whittling away at the idea that things are the way they appear.
Mm.
Breaking that down, it's again revealing that things are empty of any inherent self-existence, as the Prasangika Madhyamaka people say. And so all of these elements come together. And that would be one example of how photography has come to change the world for me.
Okay.
Change the way I see the world.
Now, you say you show your photographs, but you don't tend to show your collage. Why is that?
Well, the one problem is that a photograph is a digitizable image that can then be reproduced quite reasonably well on a computer screen, or it can be printed out. But these collages are not reducible just to the visual image. They can't be digitalized. I could take photographs of them, but what you would miss too much.
Yeah, I see.
You would miss the textures. You see, one of the things that really, really draws me is the way in which materials get distressed. You know what that means? Because I could really love a piece of paper that's been run over by a car a dozen times in the middle of the street, or something that's been torn, or something that's been somebody's scribbled on, or something that somebody's crumpled up and thrown away.
Yeah.
I love the texturing and the distressing that comes with just unconscious, naive usage of materials. So I then flatten them out, glue them, but I'm really in love with the textures. And the textures, of course, also affect the way light reflects off the whole image. So when I look at my collages, I look at them from different light angles to catch the different reflective functions of the different materials and how they all go together. And you can't do that. You can't represent that photographically. Photographically, you wouldn't even realize it was a collage. You'd think it was just an abstract painting of mosaic or whatever.
Yeah, but if an opportunity arose to exhibit in a gallery, would you be open to that?
Probably. I wouldn't go out of my way to arrange it myself.
Yeah.
No way. But if somebody decided that would like to do that, I would probably cooperate.
Yeah, okay. Right. My next question, again from someone you know, Julian Adkins.
Oh, Julian. Hi, Julian.
And he would like...
Edinburgh, huh?
That's right, from Edinburgh, yeah. And he would like to know if there are any artists or genres within the Zen or Tibetan Buddhist traditions with which you feel a particular affinity.
Affinity. Well, to be quite frank, I find that Tibetan Buddhist art and Zen Buddhist art, by and large, has got stuck in pretty much a formalistic dead end, if I'm really blunt.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean that I don't find some of these works very beautiful and very moving, actually. But as a means of advancing my own creative, imaginative life, I don't find them particularly helpful. And although, that the Tibetan paintings are all done on grids, all done according to very exact proportions, which leaves, relatively little room for the genius of the artist to find expression through them, although, there are There are definitely brilliantly beautiful tankas and, you know, run-of-the-mill ones. Same in Zen. When you see these sort of calligraphies, which look as though they've just been dashed off in a few seconds, which they have,
yeah,
they've been done according to a very, very formal constraints. And I suppose in some ways my work does mirror that tension between the constraints of form and the possibilities of chance. But I feel that the forms that traditional Buddhist cultures have evolved over hundreds of years have kind of reached, I think they've got as far as they can go.
Yeah.
When people say, oh, Buddhist art, and then they think of tankas or Zen calligraphy, I think that's a very poor way of understanding what Buddhist art could be for our time.
Yeah.
And I think that a Buddhist practice or a Buddhist community comes alive aesthetically by expressing itself in forms that are not just copying the styles of Tibet or Korea or Japan, but are actually bringing their insights, their understanding, their sensibility that they've cultivated through their practice into forms of expressivity and articulation that are more rooted in our own Western traditions of the plastic arts, creative arts.
Yep, okay. Norma Smith asks, do you have a message to communicate to viewers via the photos you take and the collages you assemble, or do you wish us to discover our own message?
I don't really have. I think as soon as you make art subordinate to communicating a religious truth, you have compromised the autonomy and the integrity of the art. And so to that extent, I'm not using my art as a vehicle for somehow covertly, you know, communicating Buddhist values. So because of my Buddhist practice and my interests and so on, obviously they do at some, you know, they can be explained as I have been explaining them in those terms. But the beauty of the great thing about the work of art is that it doesn't come with a mission statement attached. The work works for you or it doesn't. It'll have an effect on some people. Other people will be completely unmoved by it. And in that sense, I want to honor the autonomy of the work.
Yeah.
In doing so, I'm not actually interested in what people think of it or make of it or anything. I'm just interested in showing this part of my life, being vulnerable about that.
Yeah.
But much in the same way as I publish books.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for talking to us today, Stephen. It's been fascinating.
Okay. Well, thank you, Barry.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.